Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Transatlanticist Politics Podcast at the Amerika-Zentrum in Hamburg. My name is Andrew Sola. Today, I'm very happy to announce the first cooperative podcast with our sister German-American Institute in Rheinland-Pfalz, the Atlantic Academy, Die Atlantische Akademie. And here with me from the Atlantic Academy are two brilliant experts on U.S. politics and transatlantic relations, David Zirakov and Zara Wagner. Welcome, Zara and David.
Hi.
Hello, hello. Thanks for having us.
No problem. Great to see you and have you here. David and Zara also host the podcast Amerikas Verfassung, Politik und Gesellschaft in den USA, which I highly recommend, but it is in German, so you will need, except this episode, of course, won't be. But I highly recommend it. It's fantastic. And today's episode will be published on both of our podcast channels, so I would encourage all of you listeners to subscribe to both podcasts. You can find information about Amerikas Verfassung in the show notes. So would you like to introduce yourselves and the mission and goals of the Atlantic Academy first before we get started with our subject today, which is the midterms?
Absolutely. Once again, Andy, thank you so much for having us. We are very delighted to talk a little bit about our work. So the Atlantic Academy is a nonprofit, nonpartisan institute focused on civic education in regards to the United States and transatlantic relations. What does that mean? We are hosting lectures, panel discussions, seminars, exhibits, movie screenings, everything that has to do with the United States, politics, history, our culture in the state of Rheinland-Pfalz and also sometimes in other regions. And the goal is a bit to inform the citizens of our state about transatlantic relations, about the United States, because we have such a large military presence here. So we have about 55,000 Americans living in the state. So it's really nice to have a little bit of that civic input to accompany that military presence.
Yeah, and hello to all from me, and of course, thank you to you, Andy, for the invite, and that we can do this together. And yeah, the Atlantic Academy, we're as Sarah pointed out, we are a mixed institution of a educational institution or a civic education institution, a think tank, and our work it rests on three pillars, and as Sarah already mentioned, we have more than 50,000 Americans in the state, in Rheinland-Pfalz. So we can do encounter events, we can make meet and greets with Americans, and we can try to foster this German-American relations in the state, not only with exchanges, flights to the U.S. or from the U.S. So that's really an advantage we have in our region. And the second, the education pillar is, where we can host and provide events about U.S. politics, economic, or maybe some cultural events. We have the advantage that we have new funding from the German Foreign Office, and so we have been doing extensive cultural work since last year, and for instance, cinema and concert series. So it's a very broad field we work on.
All right, so thank you and welcome again, David and Zara. Today we'll be discussing the midterm elections in the United States. And not only that, it's never too early to discuss the presidential elections, even one day one week after the midterms. So you can consider this our first presidential election podcast for 2024. Indeed, Donald Trump made sure that he dominated the news cycle after the midterms by immediately announcing his candidacy for president in 2024. Love him or hate him, he knows how to dominate the news. But let's get started on the midterms. My first takeaway is this. Before the elections, there was a lot of worry about election denialism, protests at poll sites, voter intimidation and a number of other potential problems with election machines, counting, etc. But my first takeaway is a positive one. The 2022 midterm elections were actually pretty boring, and boring is good when it comes to elections. So what is the prevailing narrative about the midterms? Well, many people expected a so-called red wave, meaning that Republicans would take both the House and the Senate. And the reasons for this were historical. Traditionally, the party in power always loses seats in midterm elections. Secondly, inflation was considered to be a major factor that would help Republicans. And again, historically speaking, and this is obvious, economic problems always help the opposition party and hurt the party in power. However, Republicans did not perform according to expectations, and maybe the expectations were wrong, who knows. However, they did win the House of Representatives, and they have a 9-seat majority, which is very slim, 222 to 213. The Republicans flipped a number of seats in New York, Arizona, and Wisconsin, among others, but again, they did not win as many seats as many predicted. The Senate is considered more of a failure for the Republicans because they failed to take a majority. Indeed, the Democrats increased their majority. Well, it was 50-50 tie with Vice President Harris acting as a tiebreaker, and now it's 51-49. So why did the Republicans underperform? I'll just give four reasons, potential reasons here, and then I'll ask you what you think. One reason is that Trump chose to support candidates who are not quality candidates. And I think we're hearing a lot from many Republicans this phrase, quality candidates or candidate quality. We need quality candidates in order to win elections. So, for example, the TV personality Mehmet Oz lost the Senate race in Pennsylvania. This was a potentially not a quality candidate. Trump chose him, even though he didn't live in Pennsylvania, at least that was the accusation. Mark Kelly, the Democrat, beat Blake Masters in Arizona. And of course, Herschel Walker lost to Raphael Warnock in Georgia. And all of these were, as it were, handpicked Trump Senate candidates. Second reason might be that women and young people were angry about the Supreme Court decision overturning Roe versus Wade and therefore threatening abortion rights. Reason three, and this goes back to Trump, is that many Republican voters might be sick and tired of election deniers and other extreme opinions in their party. As a result, they split their tickets, which means, for example, the Georgia Republicans voted for the Republican Governor Kemp, but not for the Republican Senate candidate Herschel Walker. And the fourth reason that I'll throw out there, and these are just a sampling of many reasons, is that the Republicans did not create an effective message that they are better than the Democrats at solving economic problems, and namely the problem of inflation. So this reason is that they really didn't have an effective message for dealing with the economic crisis. So what do you guys think of these reasons, or do you have other reasons?
Yeah, I just want to start at the very beginning. So I think it's very important to look at the expectations first so that we can better frame the main takeaways from the midterm elections. And as you already pointed out, the look at the history of midterms shows that losses by the president's party are quite normal and therefore, to some extent, expected. And when you look in the numbers, since 1942, the average loss of seats has been just under 26 in the House of Representatives and nearly 4 in the Senate. And we have in the 21 midterm elections over the last or the past 80 years, the president's party has gained in the House of Representatives only twice, in 1998 under Bill Clinton and in 2002 under George W. Bush. And both times can be attributed to very high presidential approval ratings over 65% on the one hand due to the quite good economic situation under Clinton, and on the other hand, due to the foreign and security policy situation under George W. Bush, the war on terror, the war in Afghanistan, and the upcoming conflict with regard, which started in March 2003. And in the Senate, we have only 5 times, or gains have been made only 5 times. And here, and that's interesting when it comes to 2022, in addition to the good approval ratings of the president, the reasons also lie in the states in which Senate elections were held. So are they usually safe or swing states or toss-up states? And after all, it is only, and we have this effect that it is only 1/3 of the 100 seats every 2 years. So in the Senate elections, so there is a certain amount of states, and sometimes they are very red, sometimes they are very blue, and this makes it much more possible to win states or to gain states, even as the party of the president at that time. So that's the reason why we have five times in the last 80 years. And in the run-up to this year's midterms, these lessons from history meant that Biden and the Democrats were facing a major defeat. And you said it, the performance of the Democrats was in the end much better than expected. And because neither the economic situation was particularly good, we have a high inflation, rising interest rates, high fuel prices, stagnant employment rates, rather stagnant GDP, nor did the president have high approval ratings, around 40%. And so I calculated that with comparable ratings, the presidential party had lost about 30 seats in the House and 3 to 4 seats in the Senate. And there are a lot of reasons you already mentioned some of these. And I think that it is a mixture of first the legislature or the legislative success of Biden in the last couple of, or in the first 2 years of his administration. And second, as you mentioned, the role of Trump in the public perception of the Republican Party. So Biden has some significant legislation to his credit in his first 2 years in office: the Infrastructure and Jobs Act, the Inflation Reduction Act, up to $700 billion for climate action, CHIPS and Science Act. And there are two other things in the final weeks before the election alone. Biden pardoned everyone convicted in federal courts of possession of marijuana. That's one thing
I want to break in here because as you were discussing this, you were talking about the positive selling points of what Biden had done. And all of the four reasons I gave were weaknesses in Republicans. And I think that's an interesting way to reconsider how we shape this. Mm-hmm. One media narrative is failures by Trump plus Republicans, but there's the competing narrative, which is actually, can we whisper it? Biden is not an old senile man with dementia, but it actually might be an effective president as far as Democratic priorities go.
Yeah. Absolutely. I would second that, because if you look at his first 2 years, and he learned a lot while he was vice president under President Barack Obama, when they discussed what can we do in the first 2 years up to the first midterm elections, and in the aftermath, there were a lot of discussions about, didn't we do well enough, or was this enough? And I think that drives, or that drove Biden in the first 2 years to do as much as possible with regard to legislation, with regard to the majority in the House, and the majority, the very, very, yeah, the this very close relation between the Democrats on one side and the Senate, and the Republicans on the other side. And I think this was really a successful 2 years in his first administration.
Jumping in there, yes, those are all good Democratic, I think, you know, sells and talking points, and that they did get a lot of done, the White House and Joe Biden. But I think we need to be also a bit careful that we're now, yes, they did comparatively very well in the midterms, the Democrats. And of course, now we're analyzing the past 2 years and also a little bit that election cycle through that lens or through that result. At the same time, what we saw during the campaigning for the midterms, a lot of the candidates didn't want Biden anywhere near. He didn't do a lot of campaigning. They brought in the big guns like Barack Obama, even like Bernie Sanders or the more popular figures within the party. And Biden barely, to be honest, left the surroundings of where he lives or the White House. He didn't. Towards the end, he did a bit more of the campaigning. But we also saw that very nicely in the Georgia runoff election, for example, or in general. I think Georgia is a great example for a lot of the points you both hit on, that we here had a candidate with Raphael Warnock who focused so much on character and competence as selling points. And he really tried to localize the race too. Like, he didn't want a bunch of people coming in from DC to, you know, campaign for him, advertise for him. He really tried to focus on his competencies as a politician, as a representative of Georgia. So I think Biden, again, yes, it was a very good midterm results from a historical perspective. But I'm not 100% sure how much that can be attributed to Biden, especially if you look around younger voters, right, who played a crucial part and who showed up, I think, in the second highest number overall, but who are doing it mostly also issue-driven. Like, they are not very satisfied with Biden. Biden was sort of this compromise in 2020, and yes, and he was the one who could be Trump and, you know, a bit of a safe choice. But if we talk about enthusiasm, I think what drives people to the polls, and I know, Dave, you'll talk about a little bit about what you think that is, and maybe you have different opinions here. But I think we need to be careful when we talk about it. Is it like the Democrats? Is it Joe Biden? Is it, or, you know, or are we talking about the issues? Yeah, because that's just as a sort of footnote to our discussion.
My question to David about that other narrative that Biden actually achieved things in his legislation. The next question would be, what voters did he turn out due to that legislation that would not have gone to the polls? Like, is there a group that you're thinking of specifically? Did a certain piece of legislation help youth come out, or gay people, or Black people, or whatever?
Yeah, that's not really my field of expertise, but I would say, yeah, young people, women, especially when it comes to the question of abortion rights in the U.S. And these are the driving factors. For instance, when you look at pre-election polls, that Democrats or people who tend to vote for Democrats, that they have some issues, the main issues, and this is abortion rights, it's healthcare, it's to some extent the economy, but I think they look at the economy from a different perspective as Republican voters do. There is Supreme Court appointments. This is one of the main drivers. And I think that you can see women, young people, if you look at the voters, or if you try to characterize the voters in the U.S., you maybe would say, okay, Democratic voters are or live in urban areas. They are under 50. They are more diverse in terms of gender and race. And so I would say this is, yeah, these are the voters who are voters of the Democratic Party and maybe who see their advantages in the legislature over the first 2 years of the Biden administration.
What's interesting here at this point, if we're already talking at voters, like about voters, like, sorry, our listeners, I promise we also had kind of a list that we wanted to walk through of like the topics and issues and our structure. And but now we're already talking about, you know, the issues and voters, which we wanted to save for later. But I say, let's go for it. Excellent, Andy. Thank you. Because of your question, right, like which kind of voting groups turned out that maybe didn't before. And once again, in this case, maybe not specifically because of Biden, but I think one of the interesting developments that we saw, and now we have some better exit polls and some better analysis about voter turnout, are that the Democrats gained a little bit with rural voters. So, of course, people in rural areas, David mentioned, you know, the Democrats are really strong in urban centers on the coast. So rural voters obviously still voted in huge numbers for the Republicans, but Democrats made here some gains. For example, in Illinois, Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, Washington. And it has a lot to do with the type of candidates they also ran. So the best example, the prime example, is John Fetterman in Pennsylvania, who won the Senate seat. And he really focused his turnout, he focused his campaign also on rural communities. And we now see that in a lot of the counties, he had a bigger vote share than Biden had in 2020. And he came across, and very believably so, in my opinion, as a working class, you know, candidate, very down to earth, sort of, you know, the guy you can hang out with in a diner and who understands how shitty inflation is, things like that.
The classic candidate when they used to ask, who would you rather have a beer with? Barack Obama or
exactly.
Mitt Romney?
I would share a PBR with John Fetterman. Absolutely. Yes. And we see that in similar House districts, too. So, for example, Illinois, the 17th district, it is also one of the few ones that voted for Trump twice, but now it's a Democratic House seat, right? So what we see here, and I think that's interesting for longer term trends, and we're going to talk about 2024 later, is that rural areas are also diversifying. So we have, on the one hand, their population is declining to a degree, but at the same time, we also need to move away a little bit from that idea that rural means automatically white, automatically low income, things like that. So we have a diversifying area. And that has a little bit also to do with the fact that a lot of liberals, after the large part of the pandemic, moved to the countryside, right? They left cities. Again, the areas are diversifying in general. So I think that's an interesting development to keep in mind. And I think that'll play a bigger role in the future.
Yeah. I don't want to be the one who destroys ideas, but
students have bad topics for presentations or essays, I say, I hate destroying your dreams, but destroy our dreams, please.
Yeah. Of course, we try to identify issues who determine election results. And to be honest, research in this field shows only two factors to be related to the performance of the presidential party. It's the president's popularity and the number of presidential party seats up for election. These are the only two significant factors. And the more popular the president, the smaller the losses. And as I said before, in a few cases, there were also gains, but very few cases too in the House of Representatives. And the more seats that must be defended, the higher the losses tend to be. And surprisingly, economic values such as inflation or the employment rate have so far had little or no impact on election results. That's to some extent for political scientists, it's really devastating because you think, what the heck is going on? The podcast ends here. No, the problem
David,
is that
stop
even
talking. We'll be out of a job soon.
I'm sorry for this. I'm it's not my fault. It's research from the University of California in Santa Barbara.
Most liberal elites.
And they, it's always the same. It must be from California. But yeah, even there, the significance of these criteria are really low. It's in the 0.5 area, and that's not very high as a significant in significance. But in this election in 2022 shows that even this significance will be weakened, because this is statistically spoken, it's an outlier that we have only 9 seats lost in for the Democrats in the House, and even a gain of 1 seat in the Senate. Statistically, it's an outlier, and it's a puzzle, and I'm not really sure. And maybe we have to think new ways, and we have to think about what Trump did to this country and what Trump did to this to election itself and campaigns, because I have the feeling that we now have to see a time before Trump and a time after Trump or with Trump. And maybe this is one of the factors which cannot be calculated accurately in statistics. And that's something which I try to get my head around.
Can I just jump in with one statistic? This was from a CNN exit poll. They asked voters if Trump influenced their decision. And 54% of voters of all parties said Trump was not a factor. What do you make of that stat?
Yeah, the question is if you whether you see Trump as a direct factor or indirect factor. Something which is part of the system now, and you don't really recognize it as a part and as an effect. So that's always a problem with polls. If you look at the National Election Study polls, you can see that a lot of people say I'm liberal or I'm moderate. And if you look at the questions, are you against abortion? Are you against gay marriage? The part of the people who are against it and who label themselves as moderate or even liberal are significant. And that's something... That has something to do with perceptions, and perceptions are not really, they're perceptions, nothing more or less. So maybe it's difficult to identify Trump as a factor if you take him as or if he is a indirect factor when it comes to systems or campaigns and so on.
I think the crucial point here is, and out, I agree with you. I thought you meant to question the development of rural communities. I was like, wait a second. There's when you talked about busting dreams and bubbles. But of course, it's true. It's when we talk about election results, we always have to be careful when regarding correlation and causation. So what exactly motivated voters? And we have such a the voting block is not monolithic, right? We have so many different voting groups that it is hard to figure out, okay, what exactly were the causes here. But I would still argue a little bit that even if we have, say, one or two factors that are very crucial for election outcomes, oftentimes we have such close elections and close majorities that even these smaller issues, smaller issues, be it a Supreme Court ruling or be it specific other incidences or be it an October surprise like in 2016, might influence the people who wait until the last minute to vote and who do they then break for. And I think in this case, we also had the development that people who voted later than the independents broke more for the Democrats than was initially expected.
Yeah, I like that point. And I do want to raise this as just something for our European audience. I think that sometimes the flexibility of the average American voter is slightly underestimated. We think, and this is the theme of the split voter phenomenon. So there are people who are lifelong Republicans or lifelong Democrats, but they simply won't vote for a candidate that they think is horrible. And I just want to add a little bit to that, because I am an American citizen. I vote in Brevard County, Florida, which is a hyper deep red Republican district. And you would think that they would follow all Republican trends and stereotypes. And indeed, DeSantis, the potentially next president, we'll see, presidential candidate, DeSantis beat Charlie Crist, the Democratic governor candidate, 64% to 35% in my county, which is a huge victory. So you would think, okay, this is a very red Republican place, but look at the local issues that we voted on in our local referenda. One of the items was a tax increase to protect the Indian River. You would think, oh, Republicans never vote for tax increases. This referenda passed 70% to 30%, so it's more popular than DeSantis, a tax increase. Increased teacher pay. what would you think? Republicans would not want to increase teacher pay. Those woke teachers should get paid less. No, teacher pay increase, yes, 58% to 42%. And lastly, a new fund for affordable housing for low-income workers. Deep Republican district, they would not support this. They did, 53% to 47%. So, I mean, I think it's important to realize that the narrative is dominated, like Trump, anti-Trump, this or that, but there is a lot of flexibility and open-mindedness for local issues, like protecting the river.
Yeah, and I can add to this this vote splitting, not only on the regional or state level. Voters choose different parties for different positions at the state and federal level. For instance, in Kansas, voters elected a Republican senator and a Democratic governor at the same time. It went exactly the other way around in New Hampshire and Vermont. So I think when it comes to regional or statewide issues, I think it has something to do if you are if this affects you as a person in your community, and then I think it changes, and you have a different point of view. In the opposite to something which has to be decided on the federal level in Washington D.C., which is whatever 1,500 miles away or so, I think that's one thing. So if you are affected by a policy or by a decision, it makes you wonder whether there are alternatives out there, and these alternatives do not have necessarily the same party color as your local representative or your senator or your governor or state secretary of state and whatever.
That's also a great example, because we are oftentimes, when we talk about the U.S. political system and elections, it's, you know, more critical and is democracy in danger and things like that. But the example you gave, Andy, I think is great, because this thing of ballot initiatives is, I think, something that Germany could also learn a lot from, right? So we have elections that need to be redone in Berlin, and they also have to vote on a climate thing. And instead of doing that together, they're holding separate elections. I assume they know why. But anyways, so I think the ballot initiatives is a great example for U.S. democracy, because it can motivate also different voting bases of voters. And it can, in my opinion, again, and I haven't read all the in-depth studies on it yet, but if we look at Michigan and New York in comparison, for example, and the issue of abortion, which was on Michigan's ballot as Proposition 3, whether or not people want to enshrine abortion access in the state constitution. And just from observing this from, you know, I have friends and family in Michigan, a lot of young women who are very motivated because of that, who I never even perceived as being political in any way or form. And they were sharing it on Instagram, and they were really fired up about making sure they have access to abortions in their state. And then there's some analysis out of New York, where the governor's race was much tighter for a while than people anticipated, or, you know, where Democrats also lost quite a few seats. And there are some arguments that are being made because abortion wasn't as big of a factor here, because it was already codified in the state. That was more of a hindrance for Democrats. There were also some other, of course, many other reasons, but I think that's just an interesting comparison between the two states and what these ballot initiatives can also bring to the table in terms of Democratic participation.
Brilliant. I have nothing to add.
Wonderful.
same here. but maybe one thing, because we talked about the election results, and I think we should add that, of course, not only, and Andy, you showed this with your question and with your view on the local level. In the midterms, elections went much better for the Democrats, not only on the federal level, but also on the state level. In the gubernatorial elections, Democrats were able to pick up, I think, 3 states, was it? Massachusetts, Maryland, and Arizona. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So they lost in Nevada, but they, yeah, they could compensate this. And at the same time, and this is something, this is one takeaway for me, yeah, the role and the importance has grown significantly. Who becomes governor, secretary of state, or attorney general is much more significant this year and receives much more attention, media attention and attention by so-called experts like us. And the discussion surrounding the certification of the 2020 election, presidential election, and Trump's attempt to influence those who are in charge, the governor and the secretary of state in Georgia, for instance, this has shown how important these positions are at the state level and ultimately at the federal level when it comes to certification of an election result. And so this victory in Nevada was really important for Democrats and maybe even for democracy, for the US democracy, because we know that 2024, when it's really close, then we will see maybe the same or very similar strategies by Republicans, maybe by Donald Trump, if he's the next candidate, a Republican candidate. And that's, yeah, I think that was a really important step.
Do we want to move on to our final point now?
Almost. One more thing, just almost, okay. Almost. We're almost going to look ahead to the future. But I think one thing I would like to discuss real quick with both of you, because I haven't come mm-hmm. down on an opinion on it either way, is a specific Democratic strategy that was used this midterm cycle. And it was, I don't want to say pioneered, but in Missouri, Senator Claire McCaskill used it to great effect during her 2012 run. And it is a strategy that in tight races, the Democratic Party during the primary season, right, not the midterm elections, but during the primary season, supported Republican candidates that they considered very far right, very MAGA, very out there, to make sure that they would become the candidates for the midterm election because they assumed them to be easier to defeat, right? So just a little bit of data here. They spent a ton of money as well. According to one analysis, it was about $19 million across 12 or 13 races. They weren't successful in all these primary races to get the more extreme candidate elected. But we had gubernatorial contests, Senate races. I mean, we saw some of these play out, congressional races. So a lot of the spending was done on advertising, and they usually did it in three ways. So either they were tying a very far-right candidate to Trump, to the MAGA movement. That's, for example, what they did in Pennsylvania. They also attacked more moderate candidates, right, to prevent them from winning the primary. Or they branded some candidates just, you know, as too conservative for the state. So my issue with this is, and again, they won a lot of these races, that at the same time, the Democrats were pushing the electoral message or their campaign message of democracy is in danger. We must do everything to protect democracy. We need more moderate candidates on the Republican side, right? How dare the Republicans allow these crazies in their midst, to paraphrase. So I'm just curious, what is your take on that? Was it about time that Democrats also play politics, start to playing chess instead of checkers? And
Sarah,
yeah?
can I destroy your dreams?
Go for it.
Again.
I mean, what we forget about professional political operatives is that it doesn't matter if they're working for Republicans or Democrats. They're going to figure out a way to win. And if it means doing things that other people might find less than ethical, like why spend our money on our own positive message if that money would be more effectively spent in getting a weak candidate elected? I mean,
yeah.
And Democrats are hypocrites.
All right. That is definitely one take. No. But here's my thing.
The end of this podcast episode.
This is just the beginning, gentlemen. Just the beginning. No. This, I'm not asking this from a point of naivete. Like, of course I know politics is a dirty game. Excuse me. Our partner state is South Carolina from Rheinland-Pfalz. We know how the game of politics is played. But there are other like interesting issues connected to it, because one argument was, okay, since they didn't even, the more extreme candidates weren't even successful in all the races they supported, there's also an argument, well, that money could have been better spent, for example, in New York, where they, you know, lost the seats that would have ensured potentially their majority in the House. And I do believe that nowadays voters are smarter. And like, yes, we can say, we can be cynical about it. Like, yeah, politics is always dirty. Like, that's how the game is played. But I, especially younger generations, I think do see this hypocrisy. And I'm not sure, you know, that is a strategy for the future, especially if we look ahead to 2024, because all these candidates that have been propped up, they have now a larger database of donors, of contacts, of potential voters, of name recognition. So I just wonder, yes, okay, maybe it worked in this election, but how does that accumulate if we're looking ahead 10, 15 years when the Senate map becomes trickier, the House map, whatever. So I'm just saying, I'm not sure. Yeah, it can be effective, but how sustainable is it?
Yeah, but I don't know. I don't think that this is really the start or the begin of a trend and of a of a strategy which will be used in every election cycle. I think you're absolutely right. It's not really consistent, and it shows that even the Democrats are realpolitiker, and they try to weaken the opponent's party, but. This is, of course, a very dangerous strategy, and an important factor was the quality of the Republican candidates in this and the Trump candidates. And it paid off, but I'm not really sure whether this would pay off when it comes to a Ron DeSantis Republican Party in 2026. This wouldn't be a strategy or a successful strategy for Democrats then, because the candidates Trump endorsed were less successful than in the primaries, and even in the primaries he very rarely took risks. We have one example in Wyoming where he where one candidate run against Liz Cheney, a popular Republican, and won. But this is one maybe risky or one risk he took. But most of the time, it was very or were very safe constituencies and states. So I'm not sure whether this is a strategy for the future.
All right. Well, thank you for your opinions.
Can I,
Andy, please go.
Can I just add something? And I think this will help us move on to the final point. The point you raise is one about one about ideological purity. So the Democrats claim to be these holier than thou protectors of American democracy and the Constitution after Trump's attacks on Congress and all of the election denialism. Right. So it is disappointing when these people play dirty, the Democratic operatives play dirty by donating to extreme Republican candidates. But that kind of raises the issue of ideological purity in both the Democratic Party and the Republican Party. And Republicans have been struggling with this idea of what is a Republican anymore, what is a conservative anymore, because Trump has divided the party. And that's taking us into the future. I don't think, and I don't know if you have any insight, what the Republican Party stands for anymore. I just don't know. I mean, what will they be running on in 2024? I literally have no idea. Are they the party of sensible economics and low budget deficits and paying off the national debt? I mean, and they don't even, I don't think they even released something like a coherent political platform. So I'm really curious, if ideological purity is at stake, what will a pure conservative or Republican ideology look like in a year or 2 years from now? I just don't know.
Very nice segue, Andy, for our last part, looking ahead into the future. Yeah, but also a fair point, because for the midterms, the Republican Party released a commitment to America, I think it's what it's called, their plan for, you know, what would they implement if they gained power. And it was very vague. That is a polite way to phrase it. It was basically a one-pager PDF. I mean, there was a little bit more on the homepage and stuff like that, but it was just very vague and very broad and definitely not sort of any, in my opinion, really substantial policy outlook or where you could see where they stand.
Yeah, maybe it's the way to work with a party without leadership. And we don't know whether Donald Trump or Ron DeSantis will lead the party into the presidential election. And there are some Republicans or former Republican members of the Congress who said there will be no Donald Trump in the 2024 Republican race or as a candidate. And for instance, Paul Ryan, the former Speaker of the House. And that's really interesting. But we saw this in 2015 and 16. And so I think maybe that's one reason why this is a vague document and they don't really know where to go. But one thing maybe we know is that there will be 167 members of Congress who believe in the big lie and who believe that the 2020 presidential elections were stolen. And I think this is with regard to U.S. democracy, really a threat to it. And I think as when it comes to
jump
future,
in here, going back to the points of hypocrisy and stuff, there are 167 who claim they believe this. And I think there is a difference. If that is a winning claim to make, I think they make that claim. I don't know if we can access people's true beliefs. But
yeah, that's true.
What will be interesting to watch, I think, so the new Congress, for everyone listening, convenes on January 3rd, right? The Constitution mandates Congress convenes once each year at noon on January 3rd. So time's a bit ticking, and maybe we can also have a quick look at what the Democrats can hope to accomplish until then, maybe what they have already accomplished and what might be some of the issues that are coming up next year. I think one point that I want to make off the bat is one structural change that I think is very interesting and important, especially because we are talking right after the Georgia election win for the Democrats, which gives them an actual majority. And that means that for the Senate, there will be no more power sharing agreement, right? Because before we had equal representation of both parties. So meaning there was equal representation within all these different committees, which of course increased chances for tied votes and just like slowing down the process. And now the Democrats will have one more member on committees. And big if, but if they stick together, they can truly advance some of their own things, or they can act more effectively, especially if they want to put, for example, judicial nominations on the floor. There are less chances for Republicans to hold up the process. It's better for their oversight power as well. And of course, people like Joe Manchin maybe have less of an outsized role potentially in this setting. And footnote, because that was an article I read that I found very amusing, less stress for the vice president, Kamala Harris, because I guess her and her team were a little bit pissed during the last 2 years that she always had to be on standby during many times in terms she had to cast that decisive vote. And I guess it also interfered with a lot of travel plans and some of her own issues because she, again, so many times where she had to cast a vote, way more, I think, than ever in historical comparison. So I'm sure Kamala will be relieved as well. So any things that you're looking forward to, be it until January 3rd or afterwards?
Yeah, maybe. So for the next 2 years, Biden will have to govern in a divided government. That's for sure, because of the Republican majority in the House of Representatives. And I'm convinced that he tried to continue to get legislation through Congress. And we talked very briefly about New York, and we have a lot of, I would say, moderate Republicans from New York, for instance, who won their districts, and maybe this will weaken the majority in the House of Representatives when it comes to legislation. But in the Senate, there is still the filibuster. There is still the necessity of getting 60 votes in a procedural vote when it comes to end the debate and come to the final vote on a bill. So this will be an obstacle for Democrats and for the White House in the next 2 years. This is the background to recent efforts to pass important legislation. So this includes the Respect for Marriage Act, which is also intended to secure same-sex marriage. And it passed, I think, four days ago. So first in Senate with 61-36. So one thing, and in the House with 258-169. And this means that in the Senate, there were 12 Republicans and in the House, 39 Republicans who voted for this act. And this is quite remarkable, and I would say this is a success for Democrats and the White House in this so-called how does we call this time between the elections and the new Congress sometimes
lame duck,
but so lame is
no the other fly. The other important bill, and it was $900 billion. We just, for the non-American audiences, the defense budget was passed yesterday. We're recording this on Friday the 9th, but it's $900 billion. And when you consider, I think we've donated, the U.S. has donated maybe like or has promised to deliver $20 billion of military aid to Ukraine. That's out of a public budget of $900 billion. So that's basically nothing. So, but it's a big deal to pass the defense budget, as it's the biggest budget that needs to be passed. I'm concerned about the future of Ukraine funding. The Republicans have said that they're not going to give a blank check to Ukraine anymore. I think from a strategic perspective, that's a mistake. And the message itself is a mistake. That stuff can be said in private, I think. But I don't think McCarthy, who is going to probably be the new speaker after Nancy Pelosi, meant it the way it sounded. But we'll see about how the aid to Ukraine continues. And again, I just want to add the point that if for some reason the Republicans say we're not funding this anymore, then the European and NATO coalition to support Ukraine fails as well. So it is a big deal. It's a huge deal. And we'll see what happens about that.
It'll definitely, it'll remain exciting, U.S. politics. And maybe from my point, concluding two things that I will be looking out for with a little apprehension, I will be honest, because I mean, as part of our work, we also do interviews and things like that. And I'm sure we'll be asked a lot about the efforts of oversight in a Republican-led House, right? Because that is something the Republicans campaigned heavily with. And people like Jim Jordan in the House, they now run the oversight committee, and they already said they have a bunch of topics they want to investigate. On top of the list is Hunter Biden and his business dealings and what that might mean for Joe Biden, the Afghanistan withdrawal, the situation at the border, the handling of COVID relief funds. So there are a bunch of issues that they want to look at, but especially I think the spectacle they want to make out of, running an investigation on Hunter Biden, and which is an issue that is very popular with the base as well. I think that will suck up a lot of productive air potentially, and that might fall into the same time, of course, as well as raising the debt ceiling. So right now, you know, U.S. government funding also is like a third point, which is running out on December 16th. So hopefully there can be a continuing resolution passed, or, you know, some or procedural move to keep funding the government. But at one point, they will also have to tackle this issue of the debt ceiling. And it's not the first time that that would become a part of the negotiations with potential government shutdowns and things like that. So I'm hoping that there can be found some kind of middle ground, because otherwise it'll keep us extremely busy, and it will also, again, suck up a lot of air in the policy and politics process.
Quick final question. And you can ask your cat there, Zara, if the cat would prefer to answer.
I tried to keep the microphone closed to ours.
That's okay. 2024, Trump-Biden rematch?
I think it's really difficult at this stage.
Want to answer.
No, of course not. We've been burnt before with our predictions regarding presidential elections.
I think we had an event on conservative women last week, I think, was it? And I think it's really interesting to look at Ron DeSantis and that he has the potential to fit to the family values conservative women have. And this is something which is a misfit when it comes to Donald Trump, of course. And to add on, Ron DeSantis has all the conservative values, policy values, so Donald Trump also promoted in his presidency. So he has a point, and he was very successful in the Florida state election. So maybe he is one candidate, but as far as I know, when it comes to polls in the Republican Party, he's not as popular as Trump, of course. And that will be the question, if he can close this gap.
As a Florida voter, I am impressed by DeSantis's political skills. You probably don't remember, and I only remember this because I landed in Melbourne, Florida, and as I was driving home, it was DeSantis's first day as the sitting governor of Florida, and on Florida NPR, they were doing a feature on his first announcement. And his first announcement as governor was a new office to deal with climate change in Florida. Hmm. Except, of course, he didn't call it that. Yeah. He called it climate resilience or something else. But he recognized that all of these wealthy Republican donors who live on the beaches up and down in Florida were worried about their islands washing away.
As they
and
did
he was
partially.
Able to, yeah. And that speaks to my earlier assessment of Brevard County. He knew.
Self-affected things.
He knew, I'm going to get all of these Republicans, and I'm going to also give them climate defense. I'm just not going to call it that, but it will guarantee their donations and money and support. So he's clever. You know, he can if he chooses to, he would give Trump a run for his money. I don't know what would happen, but he's a capable enough and experienced enough politician to at least do battle with Trump. But we'll see.
I just hope they're trying to keep the primary calendar somewhat in sync. So that is just my last procedural thing. I mean, Joe Biden, again, it'll come down to him, you know, what he wants to do after this midterm. He has the power to say, I'm going to run again. But looking at his age
think of how much easier our explanations of the primary to European audiences will be when they screw it up again.
Also, yes, oh hallelujah. God. Trust me, every time I don't have to talk about the Iowa caucus again is a blessed day. That is for sure.
So, so they will start with South Carolina. It's great.
Yeah. So I'm excited to see what will happen.
Just for our benefit, maybe we should propose to the Democrats, just do it via alphabetical order.
Yeah, just the Democrats abroad. Just.
Anyway, thank you so much. That was such a fun discussion, and I hope it's not our last. We should do some more in the run-up to the 2024 presidential elections. I'm sure we'll have a lot more to discuss. And maybe, of course, it's good that you didn't make predictions, because I hold my guests to their predictions years later. Anyway, thank you so much. I'd like to thank Zara Wagner and David Zirakov at the Atlantic Academy in Rheinland-Pfalz in Kaiserslautern for joining me today.
Thank you for having us.
Thanks for having us.
And this will also be the Americas for Fossil podcast.
Yeah. Subscribe.
Please subscribe too. Thanks, everyone. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Just so you know, once again, the views and opinions expressed on the show are those of the guests or the host, not the Americazentrum, which does not take any institutional positions on politics or policy. Thanks again for listening.